Thanks to you at home for joining me this hour. Do you remember this moment in May of 2021?
What's going to be different about Florida's election in 2022? What are you about to sign?
So right now I have what we think is the strongest election integrity measures in the country. I'm actually going to sign it right here. It's going to take effect.
So there you go.
Bill is signed.
Governor Ron DeSantis, nearly 3 years ago, signing Florida's voter suppression bill and doing it live on Fox and Friends. That little exclusive became sort of a campaign hallmark. DeSantis built his ill-fated presidential candidacy on turning his state into a MAGA wonderland. A year later, DeSantis signed the so-called Stop Woke Act, a law that essentially banned the teaching of race and racism in the state of Florida if it made white people uncomfortable. Governor DeSantis supported the idea that slavery benefited enslaved people, doubling down on a new curriculum that suggested slavery was sort of a skills training program. He signed the Don't Say Gay bill, which banned any teaching about homosexuality or gender identity in Florida public schools. And all of this was supposed to transform Florida into a conservative utopia that then would put Ron DeSantis directly on a glide path to be the next president of the United States. All of it was put on display for the entire country. It was highlighted in speeches and even broadcast live on Fox News. All of it, except for one thing. There was one agenda item that was so toxic, so unpopular with so many people, including Republicans, that Governor DeSantis decided he would sign off on it very quietly in a closed-door ceremony under the cloak of night. It was Florida's six-week abortion ban. Since Governor DeSantis signed that law, Florida's abortion bans have been stalled in the courts. But yesterday, the Florida Supreme Court gave Governor DeSantis exactly what he wanted. Mostly. The court upheld Florida's abortion ban, allowing DeSantis's six-week ban to take effect. At the same time, though, Florida's highest court also decided to allow Florida voters the chance to amend their state's constitution this November and enshrine the right to an abortion. Putting abortion on the ballot in a presidential election year is the last thing Republicans wanted to happen. The last time abortion rights were on the ballot in Florida during a presidential election was the year 2012. That year, voters soundly rejected new abortion restrictions by a 10-point margin. And that, in turn, almost certainly helped President Barack Obama narrowly carry the state over Republican Mitt Romney. That marks the last time a Democratic presidential candidate won Florida. Yesterday, NBC News was first to report on a new memo from President Biden's campaign outlining how it believes Democrats might win back that state this November. Today, a group of House Democrats traveled to Florida for a field hearing about the state's restrictive abortion bans. Among the witnesses at that meeting was Deborah Dorbert, a Florida woman who was forced by state law to carry her baby to term, despite doctors' assessments that the newborn would not survive long after birth and that carrying that pregnancy to term could risk her life.
So and Florida law forced you to carry the baby until 37 weeks with no amniotic fluid and a certainty that he would not survive.
Yeah.
Yes. The next few months were the toughest times of my life as I continued to grow and experience horrible pain from the baby pushing up on different body parts. I struggled with my mental health, experienced depression, and anxiety.
Deborah Dorbert joins the chorus of women speaking out in states across this country about the absolutely appalling and dehumanizing experiences they have had to have while trying to end pregnancies in states with new abortion bans on their books. And those stories have reshaped traditional battle lines. In California and Vermont, it's one thing, but in red states like Kansas and Montana and Kentucky and Ohio, in bellwether states like Michigan and Virginia and Wisconsin, literally everywhere abortion rights have been on the ballot or been a central issue in the election, the side favoring access to abortion has won. Because the war on women's bodies is a very real menace here. Republicans have already banned abortion in 21 states. And that is something that Joe Biden and the Democrats are going to speak about unceasingly until Election Day. It is an issue that has the potential to change political reality. The Biden campaign is already running this ad as part of a $30 million ad buy across seven swing states.
Because for 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
In 2016, Donald Trump ran to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, in 2024, he's running to pass a national ban on a woman's right to choose. I'm running to make Roe v. Wade the law of the land again, so women have a federal guarantee to the right to choose. Donald Trump doesn't trust women. I do. I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
Today, Donald Trump told NBC News that his campaign plans to make a statement about abortion next week. We will see what that statement says, if it even happens, if it is even a statement. Now, Trump has sought to avoid any discussion about abortion and what he actually supports throughout his campaign thus far. Instead, he would prefer to drum up fear about phantom menaces. Today, Trump held a campaign event in Michigan focused on the issue of border security. And while Michigan is technically a border state, Trump was not there to fearmonger about our Canadian neighbors. He is instead hoping that he can drum up his own brand of rage and hurt and shock around the issue of immigration.
The 22-year-old nursing student in Georgia who was barbarically murdered by an illegal alien animal. The Democrats say, please don't call them animals. They're humans. I said, no, they're not humans. They're not humans. They're animals. And Nancy Pelosi told me that. She said, please don't use the word animal, sir, when you're talking about these people. I said, I'll use the word animal because that's what they are.
To be clear, migrants are not driving any sort of violent crime wave in the in America. Violent crime is on whole down in the United States. Multiple studies have found that migrants commit crime at a much lower rate than U.S.-born citizens. An analysis by NBC News found that crime rates are actually dropping in the big cities where conservatives have been busing migrants from the southern border. But the truth has never constrained Donald Trump in places where it might benefit him. So that is his strategy to win in Michigan. And we see what President Biden has his sets on to win Florida. The question is, which of these candidates can run a stronger campaign on threats? Both real and imagined. Joining me now is Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat from Michigan's 7th Congressional District, which includes Lansing. Congresswoman, it's great to see you. Thanks for being here tonight. First, let me just get your response to President Trump, or former President Trump, tonight calling undocumented migrants animals.
I mean, you know, look, I think it's deeply, deeply inappropriate for anyone who's a leader to set that kind of tone. I think it falls on deaf ears. He obviously was making fun of people asking him not to refer to immigrants as animals. And I think the unbelievable situation where this is, we are a nation of immigrants, right? He had family members who immigrated here from somewhere. It just is, and it's sadly like a tale as old as time in the United States, right? There were times where Italian immigrants and Irish immigrants and name it, immigrants were called animals in the past. We've seen this movie. It's meant to divide us and meant to drum up fear and anger against other people. So it falls on deaf ears to say anything about it. He's proud of it. And all his allies stood behind him and were proudly smiling while he was calling immigrants animals. It's a pretty sad state of affairs over there right now.
Setting aside the poisonous rhetoric here, I do wonder about Trump and the Republican Party's efforts to drum up fear about the border and really the southern border, not the Canadian border, in a state like Michigan. They feel like they're playing some kind of winning strategy here. Is there any credibility to that?
Well, look, in Michigan, you know, we are a border state, so we know what a healthy, functioning border looks like. And I think we need to acknowledge that no one thinks the southern border is, you know, great right now. No one says that this is how business should be running at our southern border. And, you know, as someone who is a former CIA officer and Pentagon official, spent my entire career in Homeland Security, no one likes what's going on down there. I think the question is, why is it that Donald Trump isn't letting Republicans negotiate on some sort of bill so that we can deal with the southern border. And I think that's what just drives many of us, crazy, is that he comes in, he'll do a big rally, he'll drum up all this energy, he'll lie, he'll call people animals, but then he stopped the Republicans from negotiating with us on a deal. We had a bipartisan deal. And so I come from the Pentagon and national security. If I would have said to any of my bosses, here's this number one national security issue, we've got to take care of it, we're vulnerable, but let's not do anything for another 9 months because I need to make some political hay out of it, I'd be fired. It'd be dereliction of duty. And he does it every single day. And all the my Republican colleagues who say they're worried about it, then get in a room with us. I'm willing to listen to anybody and negotiate anything. But they're refusing to even meet with us on it. So this guy is not, he's not serious about doing anything in the southern border. He's serious about trying to win an election. And it's frankly a little disturbing.
Yeah. And I mean, in addition to the lack of sort of seriousness about policy and fixing the problem on a policy level, he's also very clearly trying to divide the country, right? I mean, I do wonder if Democrats are not leaving some money on the table, if you were, by not going harder after Trump on the race piece, just because he very clearly is saying non-whites are poisoning the blood of the country. I mean, the racism and the xenophobia is embedded in the message. You know, Trump has seen gains among Latinos and Black voters in this country. And I just wonder if there's not some sort of way for Democrats to carve out that support and bring it back across their side of the aisle by focusing on the inherently, bigoted message that is central to Trump's campaign.
Yeah, I think he's bigoted. He knows that. He's proud of it. He talked about it today in this rally. It's just the problem is, we are used to a world where people feel shame, right? Where people do something wrong, they feel shame and they're embarrassed and they do something about it. They apologize. He just doesn't feel shame. Donald Trump does not feel shame. So it's just a very difficult thing to highlight when he just keeps doing it, keeps repeating it. Yes, of course, I think it's the job of all of us who care about the country to highlight what he's saying in his own words he will do if he becomes president again. You don't have to make up scenarios for what he will do. He's telling us every day. Today in the same rally in Michigan, he said, if I don't win this election, it's probably going to be our last election in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, so we don't have to make it up. And it's our job to help shine a light on that for people who might be interested in voting for him.
What do you make of President Biden's outreach? I mean, he's focused intently on Michigan. He was on the picket line with striking UAW workers. He has the endorsement of the UAW. There's been some real, retail politicking that's happened on the part of the president in that state. Is that going to be, does that work get outshined by the fear and loathing that Trump sort of conveys and brings with him when he arrives in town? Or do you think Biden has a good operation there structurally and rhetorically?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think the Biden operation has come in force in the state. They're there, they're hiring, they're opening offices, they're visible, which I think is important. But look, I don't think it's any one visit. I don't think it's any one rally by President Trump. I don't think it's any one thing. I think if you're in Michigan or in the Midwest, you got to be speaking to people's pocketbooks and their kids. You got to be talking about what you're going to do for their pocketbooks and their kids, particularly with the economy right now. You need to make the case. And for me, I always think of Michiganders in particular as very practical people. We know what we can see with our own eyes. And right now in Michigan, we have a manufacturing renaissance going on. We have an electric vehicle battery plant going up in my district. We've got 40 plus new factories in the state of Michigan after 40 years of not building a new one. So people can see dirt moving. And I think that matters to people. But it's not any one visit of someone flying in. It's making the case every single day and in ways that compel people and are connected to what they really care about, their pocketbooks and their kids.
Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, thank you so much for your time. We will be following this race intently. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Joining me now is Nikki Fried, chair of the Florida Democratic Party. Nikki, it's great to see you. We began the show talking about the 6-week abortion ban that is going to soon be in place in your state. And I just wonder, on the sort of biggest macro level, how much hope should Democrats pin on this, this ballot amendment, this ballot measure, carrying Democrats across the finish line at the top and the middle of the ticket in November?
First of all, Alex, your opening kind of sets the stage of exactly what we are here in Florida having to live under. You know, I was actually sleeping outside protesting the 6-week abortion ban when DeSantis signed that in a cloak of darkness, had a helicopter around where we were sleeping. The week before, I had been arrested for protesting abortion. So you're seeing just a 4+ years of just suffocation from Ron DeSantis and the Republican MAGAs in Tallahassee. And so when we have now abortion on the ballot in November, what this is going to be able to do is not only galvanize the Democrats around this message, but it's not just Democrats, it's Republicans and independents. Almost 1/3 of our state is independents at this point who are tired of this extremism. So this can be an opportunity for us to be able to get out our message, hold Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump, Rick Scott, and the rest of Republicans here in Florida finally accountable for what they have done to this state.
That's a political reality. And then, of course, there is the on-the-ground reality for people in the state seeking reproductive choice. And in neighboring states, I believe Florida, over 84,000 abortions were reported in the state of Florida in 2023, which was an increase from 2022. There are states like Georgia that has a 6-week abortion ban. You have people coming from elsewhere in the South that have become choice deserts flocking to Florida. Can you talk a little bit about what this means for the people of Florida who may need abortions, either life-saving or otherwise, and what, you know, the immediate future for them in the next few weeks?
Yeah, this is going to be devastating. And as to your point, not just for Floridians, but the entire South. I mean, we all are seeing these maps that just has red all over the South when it has access to abortion. And so Florida was the last opportunity for in the front lines for so many women across the entire South. So now we've got a 15-week abortion ban that was held up in the courts yesterday, which then triggers the 6-week abortion ban, which will go into effect now in roughly 29 days. So over the course of the next 7 months, until we finally have an opportunity for the people to vote back on this, you're going to hear stories like you were hearing earlier in the top of your show of these heartbreaking stories of women having to make these ultimate decisions, a decision that is so private and so intimate that it should only be between the woman, her doctor, and anybody else she allows into that space. Certainly not politicians, but you're going to see women having to make these life-altering decisions that are going to put themselves at risk, potentially, you know, future opportunities to have children. And these are going to be drastic ramifications here in the state of Florida, but also for the entire South.
Yeah. And I mean, and just the unusual nature of all of this is that the 6-week abortion ban is going to come down in a matter of weeks. So Florida women will live in, you know, the Florida version of A Handmaid's Tale and then have the option, not just women, of course, but all Florida voters will have an option to try and pull the state back to the 21st or push the state back to the 21st century and go back to protected reproductive choice, which I would imagine is going to actually help the cause of choice to be able to see what the alternative is in a very concrete way before being given this choice on the actual ballot.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly it's the point is that you're going to have over the next 7 months, the stories coming out of what happens, which let's also be very clear here. A 6-week abortion ban is an all out ban. Most women don't know that they're pregnant at 6 weeks. And so now you're going to have a state which is, for all intents and purposes, libertarian in nature. 77% of Floridians did not want the 6-week abortion ban, but now we're going to be living under it. And it really is going to bring it to light the clear choice that Floridians are going to have come November. Do you want a 6-week abortion ban or do you want access to reproductive health care? That's going to be what the issue is on the ballot. And then I say consistently across the country, don't count Florida out. We are here on the ground fighting, carrying this message, making sure that people across the nation understands that Florida and our Floridians are hungry for change and are certainly going to be putting in the work to make sure that November we get access to reproductive health care back into our Constitution and making sure that we are winning seats up and down the ballot, holding Rick Scott, who would have also signed that 6-week abortion ban if he was still governor, and Donald Trump, who wants to take a national abortion ban to Washington, D.C. That is a clear choice on the November ballot here in Florida. Protect reproductive health, protect democracy, send Rick Scott packing, and make sure that we reelect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in November of 2024.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump won the state by a little over 3 points. This ballot measure needs a 60% threshold to pass. It is hard to see if it passes that does not redound to the benefit of Democrats. Nikki Fried, thanks so much for your time tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
There is a lot of news to get to tonight. This guy went from marching with white supremacists at Charlottesville to elected office. And just a few minutes ago, his past caught up with him. We'll have more on that coming up next. Plus, the judge overseeing the prosecution of Donald Trump in his classified documents case makes yet another in a series of inexplicable moves. That is next.
It's Monday, everyone. Happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back to back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC. Monday night.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
On March 1st, Judge Aileen Cannon, who is overseeing Trump's prosecution for mishandling classified documents, held a hearing about setting a new trial date. 1 month and 1 day later, we still don't have that trial date. And in the meantime, Judge Cannon has asked lawyers on both sides of this case to do some fairly inexplicable homework. One assignment due today requires them to write a set of hypothetical instructions for a hypothetical jury that may or may not meet on a hypothetical trial date that Judge Cannon has yet to set. The other assignment is due on Friday, and it involves the so-called Speedy Trial Act. But don't let the name fool you. The likelihood is that it will do quite the opposite. Joining me now is David Latt, former federal prosecutor, a columnist at Bloomberg Law, and author of the Substack newsletter, Original Jurisdiction, which has been scooping scoops in the recent weeks. David, it's great to have you on the program here.
Great to be here, Alex.
Okay, why is the speedy trial assignment a misnomer, according to some legal experts?
Because this trial has been anything but speedy.
True.
So the Speedy Trial Act comes from the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, which provides defendants with a right to a speedy and public trial, and it sets various deadlines and timetables. And this trial, as we know, has been going very, very slowly. And Judge Cannon has asked the defendants, tell me why I'm actually not that slow. It's basically what
tell
she's...
Tell me why you don't need a speedy trial, Donald Trump.
And it's very interesting because, you know, the Speedy Trial Act is supposed to protect the right of a defendant to a speedy trial, but Donald Trump does not want a speedy trial.
So she's basically saying, look, I've gone super slow thus far and in theory could be in violation of the Speedy Trial Act. Help me tell myself and the law why I'm not in violation of it and you actually want this.
That's basically it. That's what Andrew Meissner was saying. I totally agree with him. She's trying to give herself some cover.
But it feels like this isn't the only area where she's kind of asking for cover from the defendant, from Trump's team, right? Under the guise of asking everybody for these materials, she's giving herself kind of a crib sheet that she can use to rule in favor of Trump. We'll talk about her motivations in a second. But she also has this weird request for jury instructions. They require both the prosecution, the special counsel's office, and the defense, Trump's team, to tell jurors that Trump actually has the authority to keep these classified documents under the Presidential Records Act. I mean, if jurors were given, just correct me if I'm wrong here, if jurors were told that Trump had the authority to keep these classified documents, he would be found not guilty here, right? I mean, it's not that complicated, is it?
This order is bizarre. It's sort of a choose-your-own-adventure order. She lays out two possible views of the law and says, give me jury instructions under view A and view B. The problem is, both views are misstatements of the law. So I don't really know what Jack Smith is going to do. The instructions were due today. And I've been checking, you know, news and Twitter and whatnot, and we haven't seen them yet. And it's a very strange assignment because the special counsel can't agree to her premises. Basically, the instructions are either scenario A, can a jury find that I made these documents personal rather than presidential? Scenario B, I can decide, Trump, I can decide whether they're personal or presidential, and nobody can review that. But the special counsel's position is it's irrelevant whether they're personal or presidential. These documents are governed by the Espionage Act. What she's basically done is she's conflating apples and oranges. There's the Presidential Records Act, there's the Espionage Act. They are separate statutes with separate classifications. She's kind of made a royal mess of this.
You had some scoops earlier in the week about the staff departures inside Cannon's chambers, if you will. And without getting to too much detail on who left when, one of the conclusions you draw is that Cannon is intelligent, in theory could have been capable of this, but sounds like she's very overwhelmed, overworked, very anxious, and terrified of the scrutiny under which she's under. Can you talk a little bit more about how you see or what you've learned about how this case is playing out behind closed doors, which may inform some of the decisions she's making publicly?
Yes. So federal judges have these law clerks who are recent graduates of law schools, really bright, hardworking people. The judges could not do their work without these clerks. They're essential. And Judge Cannon has had a massive amount of turnover in her chambers. Typically, clerks, they have two or three of them, and they stay for a year or 2 years. In the past couple of months, she has lost two of them, and she also had another clerk who was going to come and basically said, thanks, but no thanks. And so she has to find new clerks. This really delays everything. Everybody has to get up to speed, the new clerks, on what's going on in all of these cases. So I think that some of the delays in this case, they're not just because she's inexperienced at running complicated trials. They're also just a function of her dysfunctional chambers. Mm.
And that is all redounding to Trump's benefit. I mean, I do think there is a moment, and it may be fast approaching, when don't you think Jack Smith is going to ask for another judge on this case? I mean, given the missteps, given the decisions that have been overridden by the very conservative 11th Circuit, does he just need one more strike before he says, we got to get rid of this judge?
He's kind of in between a rock and a hard place, because generally you get judges booted off cases because of conflicts of interest or bias. And she is biased, but not necessarily in a way that's easily demonstrable. She doesn't have a personal relationship with Trump. She doesn't own stock in a company that's implicated by the litigation. Those are the reasons judges usually get booted. So she's just garden variety messing up the case, and that happens all the time.
Wait, isn't that enough? Messing up, when you say the judge is messing up the case, is that not sufficient?
But unfortunately, in our legal system, Smith he's in a tough position, because
debatable.
I'm sure he would love to get a new judge, but it's kind of like going DEFCON 3. Like it's a big escalation to say, give me a new judge. Although it's kind of weird that we haven't gotten his response yet to this weird jury instructions thing. Like, is he going to just go to the 11th Circuit? Like, it's bizarre.
TikTok. I mean, it's 9:30 p.m. on the East Coast.
Yes,
Florida's
exactly.
In our time zone. David, you have a great article that I suggest everybody read in the New York Times, an op-ed about why we may want to put more stock in the civil cases rather than the criminal ones. And the discussion we've had tonight only proves your point. Great to see you, David Latt. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Thanks, Alex.
Coming up, the politics of white grievance came to a head tonight in Oklahoma. We're going to bring you the results of a recall election targeting a Sigget city commissioner who attended the deadly 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. That breaking news is up next.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
We When did racism against white people become okay? Joe Biden put white people last in line for COVID relief funds. Kamala Harris said disaster aid should go to non-white citizens first. Liberal politicians block access to medicine based on skin color. Progressive corporations, airlines, universities, all openly discriminate against white Americans. Racism is always wrong. The left's anti-white bigotry must stop.
Believe it or not, that was a real ad that actually ran on television. Now, the claims that ad makes are so false and so misleading that the ad got a brutal 3 Pinocchio rating from the Washington Post fact checker. But the facts clearly are not the point here. The broader message, the airing of white grievance, that is the point. This ad came from a group run by former Trump advisor Stephen Miller. It is called America First Legal, and it describes itself as the long-awaited answer to the ACLU. I guess that depends on what you've been waiting for. Miller and his group are pushing the idea that white Americans are actually the ones being discriminated against, not the other way around. And they are not the only ones making that argument.
Every institution in America is under attack from this Marxist concept of equity. Instead of treating everyone equally, making decisions based on merit or qualifications, equity means that benefits are awarded and policies are enforced based on skin color and sexual identity.
Yes, yes, the Marxist concept of equity. The logic of this conservative anti-equity argument is that we should ignore inequities like the ones that exist throughout American life in housing and schools and work and policing, because trying to right those historic and institutional wrongs would be reverse racism. As illogical as that is, it is politically potent, and the groups pushing this argument are gaining ground. In the past few years, Republicans across the country have introduced anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion laws in more than 30 states. Yesterday, Axios reported that if Trump gets a second term, his allies are already laying the legal groundwork for the Justice Department to eliminate or upend programs in government and corporate America that are designed to counter racism. So now the question is, well, how potent is white grievance at the ballot box? Well, tonight we just got election results in Oklahoma for a recall election of a local candidate who could serve as somewhat of a litmus test here. These are photos from the white nationalist Tiki Torch rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. The arrows there are pointing at a man named Judd Blevins. He was among the crowd that chanted, "Jews will not replace us," that day, and now he is a city commissioner of Enid, Oklahoma. Not only was Blevins an active leader from at least 2017 to 2019 in the white nationalist group Identity Europa, but in the lead up to the Charlottesville march, he made online posts under the pseudonym Conway, including "Hitler never would have allowed this bleep." Last year, Blevins won his election by 36 votes. Tonight, the city of Enid voted again on whether to recall Mr. Blevins. And make no mistake, this election was about his beliefs that white people are the real victims of racism. This was Mr. Blevins' response to the very first question asked of him at a city forum last week, when he was asked what his goal was when he worked with white nationalist groups like Identity Europa.
What were you trying to achieve, or what was your purpose in those?
Bringing attention to the same issues that got Donald Trump elected in 2016, securing America's borders, reforming our legal immigration system, and frankly, pushing back on this anti-white hatred that is so common in media and entertainment.
We will be joined by NBC News' Brandi Zadrozny, who's live from Oklahoma with the stunning results of that recall, coming up next.
We've been following the campaign, and there have been some reports about possible connections with white supremacy. Could you tell us about that? And then Connie pulls out her sign. She goes, so this isn't you. And then his face turned beet red, and he goes, oh, so that's what this is about.
That's Connie Vickers and Nancy Presnall, two of the women who helped spearhead the effort to recall Enid, Oklahoma City Council member Judd Blevins. After discovering a photo of Blevins marching with a tiki torch at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, the two women say they knew they had to do something. Along with a group they formed to recall Blevins, the Enid Social Justice Committee, Vickers and Presnell organized a signature drive that secured hundreds of signatures, which was more than necessary to spark today's recall vote. And now, tonight, thanks to that vote, Judd Blevins is out of the Enid City Council. He will be replaced by Republican Cheryl Patterson. Joining me now is Brandi Zadrozny, NBC News senior reporter, live from the recall watch party in Enid, Oklahoma. Brandi, thank you for just putting this on our radar and also being live on the scene as the results are coming in here. To what degree, can you give us a picture of the sort of the grassroots effort to oust a white supremacist from the city council?
Yeah, I mean, you can take a look around in this room. I am at the watch party of the Enid Social Justice Committee. This is a small group of people who have had a huge effect on their community, especially in terms of white supremacy and extremism. Now, the folks around me are all very different. They have different ideas. Some of them are Democrats. Some of them are very, very progressive leftists. But they've come together. They came together in 2013 when Judd Blevins was elected. Now, we knew a little bit about Judd Blevins' past. Some stuff was on the internet. But these are the folks, like you just showed, Connie and Nancy. These are the folks who really, really just wouldn't let go. They kept going to city council meetings, holding the picture of Judd Blevins up at Unite the Right. They kept having protests. They wouldn't let it go. And now, to me and for all the people here, it just shows the power of what a small group of organized people with a goal can do.
So just to be clear, I think you said 2013, but Blevins has only been in office since 2023, I believe. And Enid is I believe Republicans have a 4-to-1 advantage in voter registration. White grievance is a central plank of the Republican Party platform at this stage. And I wonder from your reporting whether you've gotten a sense that this kind of white supremacy and the great replacement theory that is very much something that Mr. Blevins embraced, whether that actually didn't find favor within the Republican community in Enid, or whether this was largely a Democratic, progressive grassroots effort.
That's the second part of this story that you're not seeing in this room, but very much is a part of this win for progressives here, at least. And it's that they couldn't have done it alone, right? There are conservative Republicans in Enid, including the mayor, including Cheryl Patterson, who just won the seat, who are conservative Republicans, but who could recognize extremism when they saw it and said, this is a bridge too far. We don't want Nazis in our city council, which seems like kind of a low bar, but it's an important line to draw. And it's worth saying that Blevins lost this race. He lost it handily by a 20-point margin, but that still doesn't... 1,400 people voted, right? There was 30-something percent of people that still did vote for Blevins, even knowing all of this stuff. So when you talk about white grievance and you talk about the fact that these have mainstream support in the Republican Party, you're not wrong. But again, it does show what can happen when some progressive folks, when Democrats, and when Republicans who can say, this is a bridge too far, can come together to draw a line.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that this is happening on the same night that Donald Trump in Michigan is calling undocumented migrants animals, suggesting that a whole subsection of the American, American society are subhuman. And I just wonder, is there any connection towards that sort of poisoned rhetoric and what Blevins stand for? Or did they see these things as apples and oranges, the sort of neo-Nazi ties, white supremacists, and the sort of nativist platform upon which Trump is running?
I can only talk right now about Enid, Oklahoma, but in Enid, I've been talking to conservative Republicans at the polls all day. Most of the people on the city council are all conservative Republicans. And for those folks, I do think they definitely can draw a line between the things that they saw from this council member who was a white supremacist to the things that they see in mainstream conservative politics. I've talked to a bunch of them about that very thing today. They see here that there's something poisonous in a section of the Republican Party. And at least in Enid, they were able to cut it out.
Well, perhaps Enid will be a bellwether for the broader Republican Party. We will see. Brandi Zadrozny, thank you for your time and great reporting, Brandi. It's great to hear from you. When we come back, what the deaths of 7 aid workers killed by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza means for growing humanitarian, the growing humanitarian crisis in the region. That's coming up next.
From a hunger point of view, how do you see the situation in Gaza right now?
The situation in Gaza is, as we all know, incredibly bad. It's going to require all of us working together, making efforts as these any way possible to bring meals into Gaza.
The woman in that video from a month ago, Zami Francom, was an Australian humanitarian working with the World Central Kitchen, the nonprofit founded by Chef Jose Andres, whose mission is to provide meals for people in need in disaster zones all over the world. Francom helped operate World Central Kitchen's 68 community kitchens inside Gaza, which provided food to some of the hundreds of thousands of civilians on the brink of famine there. Last night, Francom and six of her fellow aid workers at World Central Kitchen, including an American citizen, were killed by an Israeli airstrike. Despite coordinating their movements with the Israeli military and traveling in vehicles marked with the World Central Kitchen logo, multiple vehicles in the group's convoy were hit after leaving a food warehouse in central Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu responded today by saying the Israeli military unintentionally hit innocent people in the Gaza Strip. This happens in war, and so we will do everything so that this thing does not happen again. World Central Kitchen and other aid groups have now suspended operations in Gaza at a time when the UN estimates that more than half of all Palestinians in Gaza, 1.1 million people, have completely exhausted their food supplies. Joining me now is Kieran Donnelly, Senior Vice President for Crisis Response, Recovery and Development at the International Rescue Committee. Kieran, thank you for joining me tonight. I just first want to get your reaction to this statement from Prime Minister Netanyahu. This happens in war. Is that a sufficient explanation for what happened?
Alex, let me start by offering my sincere condolences to the families of those who were killed yesterday and to the World Central Kitchen family and staff around the world. What happened yesterday was a horrific and appalling incident, but didn't happen in isolation. The seven aid workers killed yesterday brought the total number of aid workers killed over the last several months in Gaza to over 200. That's in addition to 350 approximately healthcare workers have been killed. So what we've seen, and I should specify the majority of those, of course, have been Palestinian, almost all of them until yesterday have been killed Palestinian aid workers and healthcare workers. What we've seen over the months in Gaza and the conduct of this war is a systematic pattern of targeting and attacks on aid agency operations, humanitarian operations, and medical facilities. Of course, things happen in war, but that's simply not a good enough explanation for the systematic pattern that we've seen unfold over the last several months.
Yeah, you talk about a systematic attacks. I mean, for people who don't understand, can you talk about the precautions that aid organizations take in crisis zones and war zones? It sounds like World Central Kitchen went out of their way to try and mark their staff as non-combatants. How unusual is it to get targeted in a moment like this?
Well, so across the world, wherever humanitarian agencies are operating, we take great care to separate ourselves from political and military and security actors. We're there to serve non-combatants. We're there to serve civilians, serve people who are affected by the wars in the midst of which we're operating. And that means distinguishing our vehicles, distinguishing our facilities. It also means sharing details of our locations with actors like the Israeli authorities so that they can take all necessary precautions, as they're required to do under international law, to safeguard humanitarian action. Despite those precautions, which agencies in Gaza have been taking for months, we have seen this continued repetition of attacks against humanitarian operations. We call it the deconfliction system, the process by which we share coordinates, share movement plans with Israeli forces. And that system is effectively broken in Gaza today.
Yeah, well, my next question would be just what is the broader effect on the agencies still operating in the region and what kind of effect does it have on them and their personnel?
Well, it's important to note that for organizations like ourselves, IRC and others that are operating, we're already operating at a much lower level of capacity than we should be, than we would want to be, given the security situation on the ground, which makes it very difficult and dangerous for our staff, our partners to deliver aid for civilians to be able to access and receive aid. Continued attacks, attacks like the one that we saw yesterday, are only going to have a further negative impact on our ability to work inside Gaza.
Yeah, this is coming as 32,916 Gazans have died since October 7th. 70% of people are at catastrophic levels of hunger. Karen Donilon with the IRC, thank you so much for joining me and sharing this information with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is our show for tonight.